Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. You know, it's always a great day when Patty Nagai comes to the studio to be with us. And this is my last Garden Talk.
I didn't even realize that today was your last one. I feel very special, very honored, and a little sad.
Yeah,
didn't know.
I've enjoyed doing this show, and especially I've enjoyed working with you. It's been so much fun. And by the way, Patty was a horticulture educator for UW Extension, mm-hmm. retired from that. Now she's a horticulturist at Shady Lane Greenhouse in Menominee Falls.
Yeah, I've kind of come full circle in my career. I was telling someone the other day that when I was an undergraduate in horticulture, I really wanted to have a flower growing business. That's what I really wanted to do. But then I got into research and that took me, you know, through all of those other degrees and all of that other stuff. And now in retirement, I'm doing what I wanted to do when I was like 20 years old.
Are you having fun?
Absolutely. It is really the best to work for a beautiful family run business. They treat everybody like family. They grow beautiful, high quality plants. I'm involved in a lot of different aspects of the business. And yeah, it really is fun. It's very rewarding in many ways.
So what was your, let's be a little philosophical. Hey, I want to be a little philosophical just to start this as we talk. You know, what brings people to gardening? What benefits do they get from it? And things like that. And where did that interest in
right?
Let me give the number.
I'm sure we're going to have
excited about talking. And if you have a question for Patty, or maybe a comment about why you garden, mm-hmm. or maybe you're having trouble with a plant, give us a call at 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. So what was so inspiring? Was it your parents? Was it?
It was my grandparents. And I feel like I have been a gardener since I was a very small child. Both sets of grandparents were very much into gardening. My mother's parents were into all different types of gardening, but they had a huge vegetable garden, which is part of the reason that I went that way in my earlier career. Before I got involved in research, I was into the vegetable production thing for a while. I have always loved plants. I've always loved the way they make me feel when I'm taking care of them, to see them grow. There's that nurturing aspect of it. You know, now there's just tons of research out there about the therapeutic values of growing plants, even just looking at plants. Looking at pictures of plants, seeing green things, seeing flowers, having your hands in the soil, all of those things we know have a profound effect on our physical and emotional well-being. We know that. But practically speaking, people garden for lots of reasons. They want to improve their home value and make their house look nice. They want to have better air quality in their home, so they grow houseplants. They are trying to learn how to grow food, maybe for the first time. They're feeling like they really need to know how to grow green beans and tomatoes. You know, it might be something really simple like that they're trying to learn. And I work with people on a regular basis with the basics of how to grow things, as well as more tricky things where they've had problems and they're discouraged, but I don't want people to give up. So I think that gardening, you know, it has tremendous rewards, but it also has those failures that we don't like to talk about, but they're there. And then surprises along the way. You know, one of the examples I like to use is that when I first moved into my home, I had a wooded area that was nothing but garlic, mustard, and buckthorn. And I was very discouraged. Worked really hard at pulling. I had my kids out there. That was my Mother's Day gift for 3 years running. Come out and help me pull garlic mustard. We pulled, we cut, we resorted to using chemicals, and finally got it to the point where it was manageable. And I felt so great about that. But then native woodland wildflowers started growing back there. And that just surprised me. And I was like, wow.
Where did they come from?
This is so amazing. I just love this. You know, it was just so rewarding. So I'm sure people have lots of stories like that where they might be disappointed, but then they put in a little effort and then something really is successful or really surprises them.
So. Yeah. Sometimes it can be discouraging.
It can be, but then it's a plant. And I think that's really important to keep that in focus. It's a plant and you can get another one. It's okay. We have lots of plants at the greenhouse and I love every single one of them. But I am so happy when they walk out the door with some happy customer. So, yes, there will be more plants. It's okay. It's okay if something goes wrong.
Well, and, you know, I had somebody sent me a note. A notice about gardening definitions.
Mm-hmm.
And what the definition of a knee is a rock locator in your garden.
Yes. Yes.
And your spade is an almost perfect back pain generator.
Absolutely.
But nevertheless, we still go out there and do it.
Every day. I feel like this time of year, if I'm outside doing something in my yard, in my garden, every day.
I was out there last night in mine because we had a great, wonderful rain yesterday.
We did too.
And I'd gone out a couple days earlier because it was getting dry and I was going to have to water. But I started to pull weeds and they're not coming. So I thought, all right, I've either got to wait for rain or I've got to water. And we got that really nice rain, and I went out, and I was having so much fun pulling those weeds, and they came right out.
I love that. I love that after a rain, and you go outside, and you just, it's so easy. It's like,
yes.
Oh, I should do this more frequently.
Yeah. It's
so kind of,
it's amazing what you can do in a
what
half hour.
What have I been complaining about? This is so easy. Yeah, the rain makes a huge difference in the ability to get those weeds out.
Well, we've got a couple of folks with questions about their plants.
Okay.
Bob in Green Bay, what's on your mind?
Well, I have a beautiful garden that I inherited when I bought my house, and it has a lot of beautiful plantings that the previous owners had put in. And creeping bellflower has infiltrated.
Mm-hmm.
The garden, and it's all over the place, and it seems that every summer I spend 2 weeks digging it out, and then it comes back, and it's very discouraging. It's just, it spreads so quickly, and
yes, it does.
I don't want to be putting Roundup in my garden, and I'm wondering if there's something you would suggest. Besides, of course, obviously pulling them out manually, I just bought something. Is it called spruce, maybe? That's like a salt and vinegar combination. Mm-hmm. I may have the name wrong. I don't know. Anyway, I'm just wondering what you would suggest for creeping bellflower.
Oh, lucky you for inheriting such beautiful gardens and then so sad that you have this noxious, beautifully flowering, but noxious weed that spreads so rapidly. I have it in one area in my yard as well, and I'm just constantly pulling it out. I haven't resorted to trying any chemicals. There are a number of different organic chemicals on the market for herbicide use that work
somewhat.
Yeah. Larry's going to complete my sentences for me because he knows exactly what I'm struggling with right now. So the vinegar products, I do not like anything with salt in it. Salt is a permanent structure changer for your soil, and so you have to be very cautious about using anything that contains salt, and please don't go buy anything you see on the internet about throwing salt in your garden, because you'll destroy your soil structure and you won't be able to grow anything. But a lot of times you can use those vinegar products. And when I say vinegar products, I'm not talking about vinegar straight out of your pantry in your kitchen, because horticultural vinegar is way stronger. It's a much higher acid content than what you have in your pantry. And so if you're going to do this, you need to buy the product that is labeled for herbicide use. And if you follow the label instructions and you do it enough times, you can kill the root systems of these plants. But initially, all it does is kill the upper part of the plant. So it is one tool in your toolbox of weed control that you could certainly try. The only other thing, if you're not willing to use a more aggressive synthetic type of an herbicide, and it doesn't have to be Roundup. Roundup these days doesn't even have glyphosate in it anymore. It has Diquat, which is horrible. I hate the Diquat products. I won't use those. I would rather use glyphosate, actually, and just regular glyphosate because it works. But you could also probably get triclopyr. There are a number of broadleaf weed control products, though, on the market that you could use. And if you follow the directions and use them safely, they will work, and they're not going to be so disruptive to the rest of your garden if they're used correctly.
Yeah.
But otherwise, it's pulling and digging.
Pull and dig.
And you know, I did that with my garlic mustard for 3 years, and I got rid of it. So it can be done.
Bob, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Debbie in Madison, we'll turn to you. What's on your mind, Debbie?
Well, I have these very struggling bridal wreath bushes in front of my house, which faces north. And they're either really leggy or really spiky or both. And they don't really bloom very well. And I'm just not sure if it's because I have them in the wrong place. So the question is, should I pull them out or keep babying them? And how do I fix them?
Okay. How long have you had those?
Oh, years.
Years.
maybe seven or eight years.
Okay. All right. So it's not something that you inherited that's been there for 50 years. It's
no, I planted them because I love them.
I love the bridal wreath spireas as well. So bridal wreath spirea doesn't, you know, for it to attain its natural form, you have to be really careful about how you prune it. It does like to have some sun. So if it's too shady, you're probably not getting good branch growth. And that could explain why you're not getting good flowers. So it
might
be better to move it. As far as the legginess goes, you know, their natural habit is kind of leggy. You can do the pruning method where you go in and take a quarter to a third of the stems out at the base to try and increase the number of branches that are coming up. But it sounds like they aren't quite in the right place. So it's not a fertilizer question. It's probably more of a lighting question and a location. So it might be worth it to try and move them into a sunnier spot.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, too. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Larry's the expert, so Larry knows the answers to all these questions. No, he really doesn't even need a host. He could just do this show by himself.
No. Debbie, I'd say move them, get yourself to a sunnier location.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Good luck. Thank you for calling. You can join in, too, by the way. Number to call, 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Open lines get you on pretty quickly, and we are looking forward to some emails as well. I'm Larry Mueller with Patty Nagai for Garden Talk here on WPR News. We're taking a look at your garden today on the show with Patty Nagai, horticulturist at Shady Lane Greenhouse in Menominee Falls, and a retired horticulture educator with UW Extension. Great to have her with us today. And just to mention, the last half hour of the show, we'll talk with Susan Carpenter of the Native Plant Garden. Well, she's the Native Plant Garden Curator at UW Madison Arboretum. They've got a really cool walk over there that you can do on a broad array of native plants, native settings. It's really quite something. It's a native plant garden.
Wow, that sounds
amazing. And you can do a
amazing
nice walk. Yeah. We'll talk some more about that in the last half hour. But right now, taking your gardening questions, and Cindy and Eau Claire, what's on your mind?
Hi. I've been told about a product called Dandelion Doom for getting rid of dandelions in your yard. I came in on the program just a few minutes ago. I hope you haven't already talked about it. I used the vinegar product in my lawn, and I had these very large patches of dead grass, and that didn't kill the dandelions. So any comments about Dandelion Doom?
I'm not familiar with Dandelion Doom. I just looked it up really quick just to see what it looks like. It's an actual herbicide.
You need to look at
I don't know what it is. Do you know what the active ingredient is in it?
Iron. Ferrous.
Oh, it's one of those. Yeah. So there used to be another iron product like that that was used for broadleaf weed control in the lawn, and it was supposed to... No, I can't remember the name of it. It was so long ago. I don't think it's on the market anymore. It didn't work. I tried it. I thought, oh, this will be great because it'll kill my broadleaf weeds. I won't have to use the herbicides. And yeah, it didn't work either. So the vinegar, vinegar is non-discriminatory. It'll
kills everything.
It kills everything. It's much like glyphosate, you know. It is, and it will kill anything. It's just it only kills the top part. So if you're trying to use vinegar on dandelions, you would have to do that application multiple times, and you'd have to be really specific about just getting it kind of in the middle of the plant and not on your lawn. Honestly, the best method for getting dandelions out without using the synthetic herbicides is to dig them out, just to get one of those little dandelion tools and pop them right out of the ground.
And they work really, pretty well.
It actually does work really well. If you've got kids that you can pay a nickel a dandelion, you can get your children to do manual labor and dig them out of your yard. But the broadleaf weed control products that are out there, if used safely and correctly, if you follow the label directions, they work really well, not just on dandelion, but on most broadleaf weeds in your yard. The problem with them is that a lot of things have become somewhat resistant, and so you end up using a multifaceted product. It'll either have three or four different chemicals in it, so that's a lot of chemicals you're throwing on your yard. And it usually takes more than one application. Timing is really critical. You have to do it like in the spring when the plants are flowering. They're a little bit more sensitive. The best time to do broadleaf weed control with any product is actually in the fall. Once we've had a good frost, that's the best time for those weed products to work because they will then take those chemicals down into the root and kill the root. And of course, dandelion is a perennial. It has a great tap root, so it's there for the long haul unless you use a stronger chemical or dig it out.
Cindy, good luck, and thank you very much for calling. Steve Chopier, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, hey, Larry. I've been listening to you for decades.
Well, thank you.
The information I've learned from you and your guests over these decades.
Well, I appreciate that, Steve, and thanks for calling today. What have you got for us today?
Well, I have a hummingbird feeder in front of my picture window, and I've got a couple of hummingbirds, and I bought a plant that attracts hummingbirds, but it turns out it doesn't like the sun.
Oh.
Cardboard gets underneath the shade of the tree. Mm-hmm. I'm looking for a plant take sun that attracts hummingbirds.
Oh, there's so many of them. Oh, my gosh. There are all kinds of salvias that attract hummingbirds. There's smaller ones, you know, like the Red Hot Sally and the Victoria Blue and things like that. But there's big ones, too, you know, like Black and Blue, Rhythm and Blues, Jam and Jazz, Purple Fizz. There's so many different types of salvias now on the market that are big and bulky and attract hummingbirds like nobody's business. Like, they are just amazing. There's even one called Hummingbird Falls that's more of a hanging one that you could put in a hanging basket, and one called Hummingbird's Lunch. Then there's the Cufeas. So the cufeas are the cigar plants. Things like Presidente and Cristo and Fuente and Vermillionaire, Sweet Talk, so many different types of plants that attract hummingbirds. But a lot of times you can get hummingbirds even with single flower petunias, verbena, lantana. All of those are full sun plants that hummingbirds will just flock to.
So you got lots of choices there, Steve.
Yes, and if you have trouble finding them, you can come see me at Shady Lane Greenhouse because we still have some.
What, you know, maybe take a minute to talk about Shady Lane Greenhouse because it's quite an operation.
It really is. Like I mentioned before, it's a family business and it's just a lovely place to work. It's kind of on the south side of Menominee Falls, just off Good Hope Road. Really easy to find. We have about 5 acres under glass. The last 2 weeks we've been getting our roof replaced, so it's very interesting there right now. So lots of work going on. But we still have really high quality, beautiful plants of all kinds. The thing that we're known for is not just our plants, but it's Carl Hornig is the owner. It's his hobby of trains.
Yeah.
So we have the largest permanent display of the G-scale model train in the Midwest. Yeah. And it's always there. It's always open. We don't charge to see it.
Always running.
We run it. Well, it depends on who's there. We always run it on the weekends and special occasions. And if Paul, his son, is there and able, he'll turn it on for people during the week. If we have kids come or somebody who's come a long way to see it, he'll run the trains. We can run as many as 16 to 18 trains at a time. It's amazing, actually.
So, Steve, you got lots of options, and you might even want to take a little trip over to Shady Lane Greenhouse or the greenhouse in your area.
Yeah, you should check out your local nurseries and garden centers and see what sort of plants they have. Basically, for hummingbirds and butterflies, you're looking for a flower that has a long tube underneath where you see the petals, and sometimes it's a small flower, but underneath, if you actually look at it, you'll see that there's a long part of the flower where the hummingbird and the butterfly can stick their little tongues all the way down, so the nectar will be really deep in the flower.
Good luck, Steve, and thank you for calling. Scott in Windsor, we'll go to you now. Hi, Scott.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, and thanks, Larry, so much for all the years you've been a It's been so good to everyone. I have questions about propagating garlic in raised beds here in Wisconsin. I grew 2 softneck varieties last year. I put them in late September, October. They got off to a good start. I mulched them in with about a 6-inch layer, 4 to 6 inches of straw. And the greens peaked through, and it all looked good. Well, I only was able to harvest about 6 cloves this summer, and I attribute that to raised beds getting too cold. Is that valid? And a related question. I mulched them in with that straw, and it is striking how well that layer of straw has kept all the volunteer weeds.
Right. Straw makes a nice mulch. It really does, unless it's weedy itself, and then it creates weeds. So you have to have good quality straw. So with your garlic, so in Wisconsin, typically we don't grow softneck garlic. We grow, Larry's over here nodding his head, because again, he could answer these questions. Hardneck garlic is generally what we grow here. It tends to do a lot better with our winters and our seasons. It sounds like you did everything right. I don't know. You didn't say when you harvested it, but, you know, it takes a full 9 months, just like a baby, to get a good head of garlic going in Wisconsin. So, for example, right now my garlic is probably another 2 to 3 weeks before I will harvest it. I cut my scapes 2 weeks ago, and that's another part of garlic raising that you need to make sure that you cut those scapes off as soon as they get tall and make that first little turn down. They look like little swan necks. You cut those off completely, because if you don't, then all of the energy goes into the beautiful flower production and not into your bulb production. But I grow my garlic in raised beds, and it does beautifully. I get really nice big heads of garlic, and I planted over 100 last year. So I'm looking forward to harvesting them next month.
And as soon as I heard softneck, I knew where this was going.
I think that the softneck varieties are more suitable for California.
Yeah.
I think it's drier. I don't know that it's the temperature as much as it is the rainfall.
Rainfall, yeah.
And the condition of the soil. So.
And you will find that you will like the hardneck just as well as you like this.
I grow the variety Music, which is amazing because they're huge and they're only like 4 or 5 cloves in a bulb. So each clove is enormous. So it's way easier to peel.
I was thinking back to when I was in Trinidad for quite a while, and somebody had given me a recipe for a stew of some sort. And I put in, it called for 5 cloves of garlic,
thought.
But when they got there, they said, where's the garlic?
And 5 bulbs?
5 bulbs.
Oh, my.
They like their garlic in Trinidad.
That's a lot of garlic.
But you know what? I then had it at their place.
It was really good.
5 bulbs. It was really good.
So some of that depends on the type of garlic, though.
Yeah.
So if you're going to grow garlic, you should grow the type that you like to eat, because the taste can be quite pungent and spicy. Like if you have something with a lot of garlic in it that is a spicy variety, it might be too hot to eat just from the garlic, you know?
Yeah. Well, Scott, there you go.
Keep trying, but go get some hardneck varieties.
You bet. And which one again? What did you like?
I grow Music. I've grow the Georgian white, Georgian crystal, and the purple Prochaska too. I probably still have some of those in there, but the majority of my 100 bulbs are Music, because it's my favorite.
Scott, thanks so much for your comments and for calling. Appreciate it. Dot in Manitowoc, it's your turn. Hi, Dot.
Hi, good morning. I would like to have you answer this question about dandelions. Okay, so the first year you have one dandelion bloom and you pick the bloom off.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and then maybe the next year that same plant will have 2 or 3 blooms,
mm-hmm.
and you cut those off.
Mm-hmm.
How long does a dandelion flower and produce?
Forever.
Forever.
Yeah, it is a perennial plant. It will just keep getting bigger, and it will keep having more flowers, and then it'll divide, and then you'll have more.
It loves Wisconsin.
It really does love our soil and our weather, and you know, they're so adaptable. It's really funny. I'll tell you a short story about an area in Racine where they were not supposed to use any chemicals. And so they just kept mowing. And they would mow thinking that if they mowed the dandelion enough, that they would stop the flowering and stop the spread of the dandelions. But what happened is that the dandelions just kept getting shorter and fatter. And so every single dandelion in that field, the flowers were only about 1 inch tall. So it adapted to the mow height of the mower. That's how smart they are.
So we're back to getting that little hand tool that is really easy. And it does work.
It does work. And, you know, you could always just learn to love them, too.
I don't bother with them. I mean,
it depends on where they are.
Yeah, there's a few in the lawn. And
I don't
care.
Like thistles. So the thistle I have to
get rid of
because they hurt.
Yeah.
I don't like to step on those. Those are painful. But dandelions are, I always
fine.
Think
I
about my
them.
Son bringing me little dandelion bouquets when he was a little boy. So, and he did not like me to dig up the dandelions. He'd say, no, Mama, no, don't do that. It's your flower.
Brian in Stone Lake, we'll go to you. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Larry, and both of you for all your information and help. This is a fantastic show, of course. I'm having some trouble growing fescue from seed.
Okay.
In two different locations where I'm trying to use fescue just because I think it's lower impact on the environment, and I think it's just a great way to go. In one location, we grew, I watered it like typical grass, where it was pretty much like maybe 3 to 5 minutes twice a day. We also had hay put on top of the seed, and it grew wonderfully in kind of splotchy areas, and there's other areas that grew and died, kind of like there was maybe dog urine or something on it, but it is a fenced-in area.
Okay.
And I noticed that underneath the hay, you told another caller, you know, how great hay can be for a compost. It was very wet and soggy, and I'm assuming way too wet for those seeds to germinate.
Probably, yeah.
And then in other areas where I didn't do anything, so I didn't, it was outside my fence, so I didn't water it. I just seeded it. It's growing beautifully. So what am I doing wrong?
You loved it to death.
Too much love. Too much love. Absolutely. So first of all, are you growing finely fescues or tall fescue?
Finely.
So finely fescues are, both of them are good. I mean, finely fescues are often included in a Kentucky bluegrass mixture for lawns that they do really well. And the reason that they do well in most normal kind of lawn areas is because the finely fescues can handle shade. So they do better in the shadier areas, and then the Kentucky bluegrass does better in the sunnier areas. And so they create this nice balance of grass in your yard. But I think you already know what went on. You used too heavy of a mulch. So when you put down mulch for grass seed, it is so thin and sparse that you can see the soil. It's like a dusting of mulch. And it shouldn't be hay. There is a difference between hay and straw. So hay shouldn't be hay. It should be straw. And it should just be a very fine, it sounds funny because straw is not a dust, but just really light. And the only reason that you put down any kind of mulch when you're doing grass seed is just to get a tiny bit of protection from the wind and evaporation. You're not covering the soil. So, yeah, so I think you already know what happened. You over-mulched, and it got too wet, and it stayed too wet, and your plants actually rotted under there. For seeds to germinate correctly, they need some nice warm soil. They need good seed-to-soil contact. They need regular moisture until they germinate. But once they germinate, they need sunlight and air movement so that they don't rot. So try again.
Yeah.
Go a little bit lighter on the mulch, or maybe
a lot lighter.
Yeah, a lot lighter. Yeah. And it should just be tiny little pieces. Yeah.
Brian, there you go. Thank you so much for calling, and good luck with that.
I don't get a lot of turf grass questions anymore because I work in a greenhouse that just sells flowers.
But you did a good job answering that one.
Thank you. You could have answered that as well, Larry.
Well, not as well as you. Pat and Casco, your turn now. Hi, Pat.
Okay. Hi. I also am a big fan, Larry, and thank you for all your service.
Thank you.
It's been wonderful. I have just 3 acres out in Casco, and all of a sudden noticed that I have multiflora roses popping up all over the place.
Oh, lucky you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. How do I get rid of them without having to use Roundup or, you know,
Triclopyr. Triclopyr is what we usually use on the multiflora rose. Yeah, that's a hard one because, you know, that's a woody plant and it definitely spreads very aggressively. You know, you could dig, of course, but you're going to be digging a lot.
Forever.
You could do the cut and paint method, which is probably the most environmentally sensitive way to use the chemicals. So, again, hard work, but it works. You go, you make the cut, you have a paintbrush or a very tiny spray bottle where you can just direct the spray right at the cut surface and then move on to the next one, just one. It's not like a broadcast spray. It's very localized. It works. I ended up using that for my buckthorn issue, and it works really well. If you have seed, however, that has spread, and it sounds like maybe you have, or you have birds that are spreading it from someone else's multiflora rose, it could be a long-term kind of a project. You're just going to have to keep watching for it every year.
But it'll be less work if you keep at it.
Yeah,
it's
true.
Each year, it's true.
Yeah.
It's much less work. Pat, good luck, and thank you for calling. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. I'm going to take a few emails because we've got a fair number here. Amy in Appleton emailed. She planted a big globe-type alliums or alliums a couple of years ago, and they were beautiful. Mm-hmm. For a couple of years, and this spring they did not bloom, but there was a lot of foliage.
Oh, interesting.
Any advice?
Well, what causes them to not bloom? Sometimes it's a nutrient issue. Sometimes it's a temperature issue. Usually the alliums are so resilient and reliable in their bloom. It's kind of odd, actually, that it didn't bloom. The other possibility
is... May was a bad month.
It was. May was just... Well, I don't know about the entire state of Wisconsin, but in my neck of the woods, May was bad. It was yucky and cold and just so up and down. But I'm thinking back to all of my alliums that bloomed, and I did not see any problem in our area with them. The other possibility is that somehow the flower stem got damaged. They don't usually get eaten because nobody likes the way the alliums taste, so the deer and the rabbits don't eat them. But it's entirely possible that somebody running through your garden may have broken the stems off. I'm just grabbing at straws. Larry, you want to add anything in there? I just don't. Yeah.
I think the weather...
It's probably a weather issue.
Yeah. Because we had some really... I mean, we went from... ice cold in May to
it was
hot,
just so up and
weather,
down.
Wet.
It was 90 degrees and then it was like 40 degrees. It's just crazy weather. So it could be that the flower stem just got damaged somehow, either from weather or some other natural cause. Sometimes bulb plants don't flower though when they're overcrowded. And that's why I mentioned the nutrient thing because when you have iris or, and I know those are rhizomes, if you have iris or you have naturalized daffodils or the species tulips or something like that that are really overcrowded in an area and they stop flowering because there's just a extreme competition for nutrients, you know, we generally recommend that you dig and divide, but there is a way around that, and that is by providing fertilizer to give them the nutrients they need at the time that they're starting to send up their flower shoots. So, you know, if you think that might be a problem, you could try that in the fall. Go ahead and fertilize and maybe fertilize again in the spring. It's a little late to fertilize now. Don't do it now.
Yeah, don't do it now. Yeah. Nathaniel emailed. He wrote in around Memorial Day about his tomatoes and that froze in the last frost. Mm-hmm. He just wanted an update. He put them in the ground, and they not only grew back, but one is even flowering. They're not as tall as the ones that didn't have frost, but he loves how persistent plants can be.
Plants are amazing. I honestly think that every single day I see something that truly surprises me. But tomatoes, peppers, eggplant, they don't like cold soil, and they certainly don't like frost. So I always say it's better to wait until we are reliably warm before you put them in the ground. And you will find that the ones that you planted early and the ones that you planted late, the later planted ones will be bigger and produce more fruit.
Yep.
Because if they get chilled, that sometimes affects their ability to, in the long run, to make good fruit. So it's better to wait. I must say that at work every single day. During April, I had people in April trying to buy tomato plants.
Yeah.
And
no.
I'm like, no.
Don't do it.
I'll keep them inside. I'm like, no, just leave them here because they're much happier here in our greenhouse. So
I was, and this last weekend I had to go to the local greenhouse to pick up another yet another cherry tomato plant that had been, the other one kind of disappeared.
It disappeared.
Yeah, there was a squirrel involved, if I'm not mistaken.
And they will definitely disappear your plants. Yes, I have all of the issues in my yard. Yes.
And I was kind of almost pleasantly surprised. I was a bit surprised, and then I thought, good for them. There were a lot of people just getting their tomato plants for the first time.
We are still selling tomato, eggplant, and pepper plants, and they are absolutely gorgeous. The plants are big, and they're huge, and they're ready to go in the ground, and the ground is now nice and warm.
Yeah.
I planted this year, you'll laugh at this, I planted a little, I'm calling it my diversion garden, because I planted a garden outside of my garden with the extra pepper and eggplant, and I even threw in a couple of melons and cucumbers and things just outside of my garden area, because I figure that is going to be the garden for the chipmunk, squirrels, and the deer. And I went out there this morning, and someone, I'm not naming names, but someone came into that little diversion garden and very methodically ate every single eggplant, the whole plant. The stems are there, but the plant is gone.
Oh, I'm bad.
So
I
have somebody coming through my yard at night who really likes eggplant. Yep.
Well, there's an eggplant. Plant loving animal in Patty Nagai's
neighborhood
extra garden.
I'm almost thinking I should go plant some more, because otherwise they might hop over the fence and get my real eggplant.
One of my squirrels, I had two in the yard. One of them was bopped on the head with a baseball size hail and killed.
Oh my gosh.
You should have seen, I mean, literally.
Wow.
Baseball size hail we had. So
wow,
I'm getting a new roof.
You're getting a new roof, and poor squirrel.
And
oh,
the poor squirrel passed away.
That's
on that
sad.
Happy note.
Yes. Oh my gosh.
Patty Nagai, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here for Garden Talk with my guest, Patty Nagai, horticulturist at Shady Lane Greenhouse in Menominee Falls. Great to have her back for another Garden Talk. And we have callers online, and we've got emails. Let's go to the phones. Dave in Green Bay, thank you for calling.
You're welcome, Larry, and thank you for helping to spread your knowledge and that of your guests to all of the people all over Wisconsin. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
You're welcome. We'll miss you. We were talking about hail just a minute ago, and about a week ago, there was pea-sized hail that hit my hostas as well as my garden plants. And they took a beating. But then this last week, there was another hailstorm of pea-sized hail, and my plants took another beating. And I guess I'm wondering, the cucumbers look like they're just about done, but didn't know if I should replant tomatoes and peppers and some of the other things I have in my garden.
Wow, that must have been quite the hailstorm. And then two of them back to back. That's no good for your plants. Again, plants are super resilient, and they can come back after some significant physical damage like that. But if it has reduced the leaf area so significantly, it's going to take a lot of energy for them to make all new leaves and get kind of caught up. It might not be a bad idea to replant some of them, and then the ones that look better, you can kind of hold on to those, of course. I wouldn't worry about the hostas. Hostas are very resilient, and they will come back. If the leaves look really bad, you could just cut them off at the base, and it'll make more leaves. I mean, my hostas get regularly eaten by my eggplant-eating deer, and they come back beautifully, bigger every year.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't worry about the hostas. But as far as your vegetable plants go, if you can get locally grown, really good-sized vegetables still at your local greenhouse, your local nursery, I'd say go ahead and put some of the newer ones in, just as kind of a backup plan. And you might want to hold on to the ones that are damaged just to see if they recover. It really depends on how big they are and how much damage there is. They do grow foliage really quickly.
Yeah.
Especially tomatoes. Tomatoes, you know, can withstand a tremendous amount of foliage damage and still be able to grow and produce new leaves and fruit. But it's really a relative thing. You'd have to, have to see how much is left.
Lynn in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I think you might have just answered my question, but it's a hosta question. And what happened for me is that my beautiful hostas are so happy right now, but they got painted by the handyman.
Oh.
A bunch of paint dripped on them. So now I have painted hostas.
Oh,
and I was wondering, you know, should I just cut all of the leaves that have paint on them, or what would you do if you were me?
Is it attractive? Is it a beautiful color?
No, it's a nice brown that looks great on the house, but not
on your hostas. I was thinking if it was a, you know, some exotic color and a nice little splatter pattern, it might be kind of fun. But if it's brown, I would just cut them off.
Yeah, cut them off.
Yeah. So the paint's not going to hurt the plant. It might, in the exact area where the paint spot is or the stripe or whatever it is, you know, it'll probably kill the tissue directly underneath the paint. But it's not going to hurt your plant. I would say just cut off the worst of it, and don't completely defoliate your plant. But they'll grow new leaves. It'll be okay.
Lynn, thank you very much.
Painted the hostas. Painted hosta. I think isn't that a name of a hosta? Painted.
That it should be.
I think there is a painted hosta.
Well. I'll look that up over our news break.
Yes.
For now, Lynn, thank you. And John in Green Lake, what's on your mind?
Well, thank you for all your decades of service, Larry.
Thank you.
You're a great guest. And, we had a situation where we grew a lot of potatoes last year in raised beds and in pots.
Mm-hmm.
We ended up not eating them all during the year. And so by this spring... Well, it's kind of like when Larry goes golfing, you know, and he puts, they had eyes, and they had lots of eyes, and my wife diligently cut them off. We cooked the rest, but we put some in the pots that were on the south-facing steps. We put some in the ground in the garden, and for about 3 weeks, the ones in the pots were going great, and the ones in the ground didn't come up at all, and my wife said, about time to get the pots off the back steps, so go put them out in the garden, and so I said, okay, I'll put them right next to the ones in the ground, and maybe the ones in the pots will pop the ones in the ground are coming up. The next day, the ones in the grounds were up.
Yes, because that is science for you right there. That is totally good science. Give that motivation and encouragement. Look what your brothers are doing. Your brothers are growing. You should grow. So, yes, that's exactly what happened.
Yep.
So funny. So I'll tell you what the difference is. The difference is soil temperature. So your pot, if you were to measure the temperature for the last 2 weeks in that pot versus the ground, I bet there was at least a 10 to 15 degree difference.
Yeah.
It just makes such a huge difference. If you're growing in a raised bed or a container versus the soil, I mean, people think that the soil is always really warm, but even in the southeastern part of Wisconsin, where I am, the soil temperature stays so cold for so long. That's why I discourage people from planting, you know, tomatoes.
Early,
not at all. Of course, I want you to plant your tomatoes, but at the right time when the soil is really warm. When people were trying to plant tomatoes in the middle of May in my neck of the woods, the soil temperature was still like 50 degrees, which is really cold.
Now, it's right on the edge.
Yeah, and potatoes can handle that kind of cool temperature, but they're not going to grow as fast at 55, 60 degrees as they will at 75 degrees. They'll grow a lot faster.
And so, there's been some research on how plants communicate with each other. I might get to that. There was some really cool stuff about a plant being injured on purpose.
Oh, yes.
We can talk about that, but we
plants
first
talk to
need
each
to
other.
Take a look at the news.
Okay.
That's next.
Okay.
But Patty Nagai will be back after the news, and she's with us for another half hour. I'm Larry Mueller. We'll be right back. You, my friends, are listening to Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Patty Nagai. Patty, a horticulturist at Shady Lane Greenhouse in Menominee Falls, Wisconsin. It's great to have her back. Lots of callers online. The lines are full. Lots of emails. So let's get right to it. Lori in Stevens Point, what's on your mind?
Well, Larry, I just want to say how much I will miss you.
Thank you.
I've learned so much from you, and I wish you a very fruitful retirement.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. I have a perennial garden that has a plethora of blue and purple spiderwort that I am very attached to because my husband planted them, my late husband planted them many years ago. And my question, they're in their glory right now. My question is, will they rebloom if I cut them back after they're
after
done with
flowering? Mm-hmm. Hmm.
You know, I actually don't know the answer to that. And I would say it would be worth trying to see whether or not they will rebloom. But it seems like they are more seasonal than stimulated by pruning. But you could certainly try. I do know that they transplant really well. And you could, you know, you could certainly, after they're flowering and you cut them back, you could take that time to dig up a few and move them to a different part of your yard or start a new garden elsewhere just to spread the beauty and the love, the love of the spiderwort and your husband. I think that would be lovely. But I, you know, I honestly don't know, but certainly try
it.
It's not going to hurt them. It will not hurt them to do it. And you might be rewarded with some additional blooms in, you know, maybe a month's time. It would be worth trying.
Absolutely.
And maybe one of your listeners has tried this before and had success. But sometimes that is how we figure things out. You just give it a try. It's not going to hurt the plant. And that's our first rule. You know, you don't want to do any harm, but definitely worth the try.
Yeah. Good luck with it, Lori.
Yeah,
and thank you.
Thank you for your call.
Jim in Sturgeon Bay, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes, good afternoon. I'm struggling with wild strawberries taking over my backyard. We moved into our property about 5 years ago, and the house needed a lot of work, and so about the only thing that was done outside is the yard got mowed. Well, now that the house is getting itself under control, it's time for me to try to get the yard under control.
Okay.
And the wild strawberries are simply everywhere. And if there was something, if it was a small patch that I could dig up, I would attempt it.
Yeah.
But this is just everywhere.
They just love
your
yard.
And so I appreciate any ideas that you might have.
Well, it is a broadleaf plant, and so you have the traditional broadleaf weed control products that you could probably use. But sometimes with those types of weeds, proper fertilization of your yard, keeping the mow height kind of tall, maybe overseeding, and it's the wrong time of year to seed right now, but you could wait until like the middle of August or through September or so to put down some grass seed. You could try that and try fertilizing. Keep the mow height high. Try overseeding, and it might cut back on the population. But if they're that ingrained in your yard and that happy in your yard, you're probably going to have to use some type of chemical control, at least initially. But right now is maybe not the best time to do it. So if you can hold on until fall and just practice some good lawn care techniques of, you know, getting a little fertilizer down, keeping that mow height a little on the high side.
I'm set at 4 inches.
Four. That is pretty high.
That's pretty high. Three is probably.
3 to 3.5 is, you know, the usual recommendation. But 4 is okay with me. But the taller you keep your grass, the better able it is to shade out any type of broadleaf weed starting in your plant in your yard. But of course, you already have these well established. But wait until fall and do, you know, just do that one broadleaf weed control in the fall, right after the first frost, and they probably will go away because they're not that hard to kill.
And then keep the lawn.
And then keep practicing those good lawn care techniques, because you can do a lot without using chemicals if you just fertilize and mow high. You can do a lot for your lawn just by doing those two things.
Jim, good luck, and thank you for calling. Peggy in Madison, we'll go to you. Hi, Peggy.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. And Larry, I can't wait to get my T-shirt to celebrate your retirement. Have fun.
Thank you.
Anyways, a dear friend of mine whose husband passed away, so she's kind of, I told her, let me call and ask about this. She recently had her house treated with for termites around the base of the house and made it perfectly clear, no pesticides to the yard. Well, about a week later, she came home and she saw signs all over for these pesticides all over her yard. And she has wildflowers in her yard and she collects them for tinctures and different remedies that she mm-hmm. uses. And is devastated. Plus, she has a pet. And just, she sent me a list of the chemicals that they use.
Mm-hmm.
And I can read that to you if you'd like.
It's probably 2 or 3 kinds, I imagine.
Yeah. One active ingredient is lambda-cyhalothrin,
mm-hmm.
also called synthetic
pyrethrin. Yeah. That's the typical one to use around houses.
And then all of these were to kill fleas, mosquitoes, and ticks. And then another one was Pivot 10-IGR, but I looked it up, and you can't find anything on the website because mm-hmm. the website changed to a different website.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that one. You know, there are a couple of things that I would recommend. One is that that you or your neighbor call the Department of Ag, Trade and Consumer Protection with your information, and they will be able to give you some better ideas of what you can do going forward. I will say, though, that the synthetic pyrethrin is very commonly used around houses for termites, ants. It's used as a barrier spray around houses to keep bugs from coming in the fall. It's very commonly used. But pyrethrin is it's a synthetic product of an organic compound, so it's a natural compound that's been synthesized. But yeah, it sounds like there was a communication problem. It would be good to know to what extent that they applied the chemicals, where they exactly applied them. It could be that they only applied them around the house to prevent to take care of the termites. And they have to put those signs up because they did a chemical application on that property. But if they actually applied it to her entire yard without her permission, that is a DATCAP question. So yeah. I would say you need to
go back
call.
I'd go back to the company.
Yeah, and clarify. You need clarification on where they exactly put the chemicals down and when and how much and all of those things. And then you can go through the Department of Ag to get more information about what kind of repercussions there might be.
Yeah, and thanks for calling, Peggy. Martha in Hawkins, your turn. Hi, Martha.
Hi. I live in Hawkins, and I found out we moved here 2 years ago, and this is new to me. I tried to plant a lilac, and I dug it down about 8 inches and hit rock. And I tried that in another spot in the yard, and I same thing all over my big yard. And I was told it's hard pan. So we have, it's like river rocks mm-hmm. that have this kind of crunchy clay between them. And I put a, you know, filled the hole with water and it sat there for 2 days.
Oh, dear.
So How deep would this be? I don't know if you can know that, but and how extensive is it? Is it something that covers the whole area I live in, or is it something that's like a riverbed, or what?
It could be either or. So in your yard, do you have trees and shrubs?
We have two planted trees.
Okay.
One's a big spruce and one is a hawthorn. Not a hawthorn.
Okay.
A buckthorn. Well, I think it's a buckthorn.
Oh, well. Yeah. Sorry about that, but... I would look in the general area and see where you have plants growing that might have deeper root systems and maybe try digging in that area just to see what's under there. Otherwise, you kind of need a geologist or you need a geological map to look and see how extensive that is. Do you have a basement?
Yes, and it's dry.
So when they dug your basement... Oh, it would be so fascinating to see the soil profile.
Yeah.
From when they dug your basement. But without actually seeing a very detailed soil survey map or a...
I'd go to the guys that dug the basement.
Yeah. You might want to ask them if you have any neighbors nearby. You might ask them for advice. Otherwise, look in your yard and just see where things are growing really well and... use that as kind of a gauge of where this hard pan might not be.
Yeah.
So I'm not a geologist, but it sounds like it might be, I would guess it was just in part of your yard because otherwise nothing would grow.
Right. Nothing with roots, deep roots.
Yeah. Because because the water's not going to drain. It's not just that that can't be penetrated by the roots. It's if the water accumulates there, that's not a healthy environment for most plants.
Yeah.
So, wow, good luck with that. That's a new one for me, too. I've never had anybody ask me that question.
I would go and talk to the people who
dug the basement. Because it would be fascinating to see the profile.
Yeah, it would.
Wow.
Martha, good luck, and thank you. Abby in Madison, your turn. Hi, Abby.
Hello. So my question is, we have several flower gardens, and in a few of them we have gout weed that I've been battling for many years, and we pull them the best we can, but they just come back stronger. Mm-hmm. Is there any way to get rid of it?
I wish I could tell you something really positive about a way to miraculously clear the property of goutweed, but it is one of the worst. I've had people with this in their perennial gardens, and then we've just ended up completely decimating the garden, like all the way to the ground, dug everything out, applied glyphosate multiple times. It is just a nightmare to get rid of. It is... That's just such a terrible thing for me to say, but it's true. It's just really hard. You have to be incredibly persistent to get rid of it. It is so aggressive, and every little piece of root becomes a plant. It makes my heart hurt for you. I'm so sorry.
Abby. Yeah.
Persistence is all. It's just persistence, and you can try the painting method. You can pull, you can dig, you can paint with an herbicide, but it's going to take a long time. I'm so sorry.
Thank you, Abby. Good luck. You've got a lot of work ahead of you, I'm afraid. Mm-hmm. Well, Dustin emailed wondering if American hazelnut plants would work as understory plants for a larger pin oak. It would be on a slight hill in Oregon, Wisconsin, with clayish soil, and wondering if that would work and if there's any other types of, any recommendations for this type of site. Again, this is slight hill in Oregon and a plant community, you know, interested in getting something going.
I think the corolla species, there's a lot of work being done in Wisconsin on hazelnut, and so you should be able to find some even cultivars that would do really well in that situation. The other thing that I would look at are maybe some of the shrub amelanchiers, the service berries. Elderberry does really well in that kind of situation. If you want something more ornamental, you could look at like an oak leaf hydrangea that does well. And then, of course, there's tons of perennials that will grow as an understory plant. If you're looking for more shrub kind of things, though, I think the hazelnut is a great choice.
Yeah, and if you type in Wisconsin hazelnuts, there's an organization mm-hmm. that has some good information, and as you say, they may even have some great suggestions for particular
but
ones.
But I think hazelnut, serviceberry, elderberry, there are lots of different options for you in that situation. Good luck with that. That's a great project to undertake.
Lisa emailed to ask how to get rid of Creeping Charlie in a lawn without killing the lawn, and how do the squirrels know where you plant bulbs?
They watch you from their perch up above.
God.
They know. They can detect soil disturbances. They're just amazing at figuring out where you've planted anything, and they just go dig it up.
They're killing off some potted plants on my yard, on my deck, and I'm just leaving they're doing it sort of on one side, and the plants on that side are dying, but I'm just leaving them there because if I take them out, then they're just going to come and dig the rest up.
They'll just dig it up again. They're very consistent in that way. For the ground kind of stuff, or even in pots, Larry, you know, you can put down pieces of hardware cloth.
Yeah.
And it discourages them. There are also some really interesting new repellents out on the market for squirrels and chipmunks that have a lot of them are organic or at least natural. They have a lot of cinnamon and garlic and various types of oils in them and fragrances. Some of them have garlic in them. Some of them have capsaicin.
Yeah.
Lots of different products out there that you can use as repellents for the squirrels. But as far as digging up your tulips, you know, they're probably replanting them somewhere else. So maybe your neighbor is benefiting from that. I know I have tulips in my yard that I didn't plant. I was like, thank you, squirrels. I don't know where you took those from, but they're gorgeous. And then what was her other question? I got off onto the squirrels, but she had another question. What was it?
Well, she just wondered how they know. And Creeping Charlie.
Creeping Charlie. Creeping Charlie is one of those plants that is very persistent. It's not that it's impossible to get rid of. And again, you can use broadleaf chemicals, but the time to do it is when it's flowering in the spring. And then again in the fall, after the first frost, if you put down a broadleaf weed control product, it usually will take care of the Creeping Charlie. Otherwise, you'll be pulling and pulling and pulling. And
I once, this is many years ago, decided I wanted to get rid of it. And I had somebody come in and we eliminated every sprig, and and the lawn looked just wonderful. But then the next year, the neighbors had it, and it starts coming back in, and pretty soon it's all over the place again.
Mm-hmm.
I have given up on that. I have learned to live.
It has a lovely little purple flower.
It does. I've
and
learned to
so
live with it.
And it's so very green. It's just, I have it in one of my gardens, and, you know, when I see it and it bugs me, I'll pull it out, but then I just don't worry about it
because
it's a nice little ground cover. And, you know, it was imported into this country as an ornamental plant.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, there, it's doing its job.
I understand you have a question for me.
I do have a question for you. It's kind of it's a two-part thing. So my first part is, you know, you are so amazing and you've had so many different interviews and discussions over the years with all of these experts, and you have amassed this amazing amount of knowledge, right? You know that you sit there and you answer the questions before I can even get my mouth open. You've got it, the answer for everything. So my first thought was, I can imagine you in retirement going up to some mountaintop and being this like garden guru. People come up to you, "Oh, wise one, can you answer my question?" Are you going to do that? No.
That will not happen. Here's the only expert advice. Well, no, not take out expert. The only advice I give typically is when I'm going around in my own neighborhood and somebody says, "What do you think's wrong with this tomato?"
Well, that's or good to whatever. Share your knowledge. And, you know, I do that every day, too, with neighbors and friends and people at work. But my real question is, you are a man of learning, lifelong learning. You are like the epitome of this Wisconsin idea of learning always. What do you want to learn next? Do you have a challenge? Do you have a project? Do you have a goal? A new thing that you're going to do?
Well, I'm on a board of an early learning center, and it's been a very good. I mean, it's really good people there, and it's plumb full always with long waiting lists. So we're adding to that. So we're doing a construction project.
Oh, wow, and that's different. So that's great.
I'm on the subcommittee, the building committee. So one thing I'm learning a lot about is working with, and not only me, a team of us, working with architects and builders. And there's that, and there's some fundraising that gets involved, fundraising that's different from the way we do things here. So I'm learning a bit about that. And this whole process, it's going to be like 2 years. You know, we're talking a few million dollars here.
Well, that's a big project.
Yeah, it's a big project. Yeah. I'm going to be learning a whole lot about that.
That's excellent. It's good to have new things to do and...
Yeah, and I'm on, you know, some other service groups, and I'll be getting... I haven't been involved with them because...
You were too busy.
Yeah, and now I can spend some more time on service dogs and vets and kids. Those are the three areas that...
That is fabulous.
So I'm sure it'll be learning a lot there.
I bet you will learn something new every day.
And I'll try.
Thank you for all of your years. It has been such a pleasure for me to come in and talk to you. I mean, I know I only do it a few times a year, but it is fabulous.
Well,
I will miss talking to you.
I will, too. I've got to come see you at Shady Lane Greenhouse.
Absolutely.
I've long thought about it, and every time I think about it, and then the time goes away, and where have I been? I have not been to Shady.
Well, we are open year-round, so you can come see us anytime. You'll never believe what we're planting next week.
What?
Poinsettias.
Oh, of course.
It's time to think about Christmas in July.
Patty, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for
all your friendship
and for your expertise. It's been wonderful. Thank you so much. Patty Nagai, she's not going away forever, I don't think. Jill Nadeau, who's going to be hosting Garden Talk, is going to be on the phone or via email to get Patty back. And I'm sure she will be back.
Well, she has my phone number, so.
Yeah. Well, I'll look it up, too. friend of mine, Susan Carpenter, is up next from the UW-Madison Arboretum. We're going to talk about native landscaping. That next. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk. Great to have you along for Garden Talk. You know, the University of Wisconsin-Madison Arboretum has an amazing history. The original planters, I don't think realized at the time, but they introduced a new concept in ecology, ecological restoration. It's the process of returning a piece of land to a previous, usually more natural condition. And up next, we're going to be talking about some of the native communities they created with our guest, Susan Carpenter, back with us. She's the native plant garden curator and gardener at the UW Arboretum, and she's going to be telling us about what you'll find when you visit. And I hope you do. Do you tour arboretums to get inspiration? Where are your favorites? What native plant is looking great in your garden right now? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org. Susan Carpenter with us by phone. Susan, thanks for joining in today.
Hey, great to be here, Larry.
What is, again, I'm going to go right to a very basic thing because somebody asked me about this. What do you do as a native plant curator?
Well, curator is a term that refers to someone who, if you think of it in the museum context or in this case the botanical garden context, we're overseeing the collection of plants, or in my case, it's actually a grouping of gardens that represent native plant communities of southern Wisconsin. So we have prairie gardens of different types, savanna gardens, woodland gardens. We have some wetland areas that are rain gardens. So the curator, and I think the word gardener is helpful here too, because the curator and the gardener is the same person. And so my hands are a little dirty. My knees are a little dirty today, of course, because besides overseeing the garden, we're working side by side with volunteers. A couple of my volunteers this morning, when I mentioned I'd be talking with you today, said, "Oh no, he can't retire, but he deserves it." And then my students working with me during the summer. So we're all out there. We were doing some weeding. We're preparing a new garden bed area. Our garden designer created a new area, designed a new area, drew it out for on a landscaping plan. So we were setting up the boundaries of that and removing some sod and planting some plants. So it's just an exciting time to have kind of all aspects of gardening is what the curator here does with our gardens.
Well, and you've got, I'm looking at this map of your Wisconsin native plant garden, which is just absolutely great. How big is the native plant garden?
Well, the native plant garden here is about 4 acres, and we've got it pretty well filled. A very little of it is turf grass. So now we've planted out almost all of it into beds and also these, you know, under the trees. The trees have really grown up a lot from the time that they were planted about 24 years ago. And so it's we've got filled in under the understory, the different plants that would go with those particular trees. So it's really a nice demonstration garden for people to use to see how they could grow native plants at home. And also it serves as a bit of an introduction to our larger mission that you mentioned at the opening, which is to restore native plant communities and to maintain restorations, manage restorations of all the different types that will be suitable for southern Wisconsin and suitable for the land that we steward here, because we have 1,200 acres of arboretum here.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of areas to care for.
What site is looking best right now?
Oh my gosh, it's hard to say because everything's growing about 6 inches overnight, and more things coming into bloom. I think the one area that I'm really fond of at the moment is the mesic prairie garden. So kind of medium moisture, soil moisture. It's kind of inspired by the tall grass prairie. So we have some of the taller plants there. The things that are blooming now that are just so pretty. The indigo is still blooming. Some of those are still blooming. The wild white indigo. The bee balm just started in that garden just today, and as today was the first day I saw a bloom open on that plant. The pale purple cone flowers have done really well this year. We've got the bright orange oxeye sunflower is blooming now. So there's just a lot of variety coming into bloom now. This July is really when the peak of blooming comes in that area. So it's just very, very pretty. Lots of variety, lots of diversity of plants. And then, of course, our insects are coming in. We've been able to document the rusty patch bumblebee pretty often, actually, this
that's
summer.
Cool.
So that's very neat. Yeah.
So for the person who might be thinking about having one of these types of native plant gardens, how do you keep the sites healthy?
Well, what we usually encourage people to do is to make sure as they're considering what plants to plant or to expand in their gardens, consider what kind of a site it is. Because if you can get a close match, I don't mean exact match, but a close match with the type of plant and the type of site. If you can match those two things, then you're going to be in luck. So, for example, lots of people have a big tree or multiple big trees in their yard, and they might have a kind of dappled shade, or they might have a very deep shade. So those are things to consider when you're selecting the plants that would grow under the trees or in those beds. And one neat thing to do with a big tree is to make basically a flower bed under its drip line so that you can grow woodland flowers there, and you can also protect the insects that are using that tree and then reproducing and providing all the food for the bluebird and the other insectivorous birds or birds that are using insects for their nesting period. So just as an example. Also, if people have a garden and something is doing well there, like they have a native plant that's doing super well on their site, I usually like to know what plant that is or what plants those are, because then I can suggest other plants to increase the diversity, increase the blooming throughout the season, increase maybe the animals or wildlife that would be attracted there.
All good points. Do you have problems with invasive much there?
Yes, we do have invasives. The good news in the garden is it's kind of a small area, and so the best thing to do is to kind of keep an eye on what's coming in. And in some cases, we don't have really weedy. We might not have a weedy species, but we might even have a native species that's kind of taking over a bigger share of the space than it, not sharing the space with the other plants. So we might even manage some of the native plants, take them,
yep.
Remove them so that it releases they may be shading other plants, or we may be able to add, remove some of that. We just did that this morning, removed a patch of plants that were kind of taking over an area, the Canada goldenrod, and then we planted another plant there that will be blooming later in the season, about the same time that the goldenrod will be blooming and about the same height. So we just are putting it in that suitable site and watered it in, and with the rains we've been getting, things are growing really fast.
Yeah, they surely are. They surely are. And so you don't mind getting rid of even, quote, good plants?
Well, in the garden setting, we have a limited amount of space. I mean, and gardeners are usually pretty good at seeing that something might be, might be taking over a little too much space. So it's kind of it's a gardening approach, really. I mean, if I were on a larger site, if I were on a prairie restoration or a prairie area, a floodplain or something, I wouldn't use the same practices because there's plenty of space there and there's really, more room for all the plants. But in the garden setting, it's kind of, so for an example, I have a volunteers who kind of complain about how much wild ginger they have, like they have too much wild ginger. And then I have volunteers in the same group who wish they had some wild ginger in their garden. So we need to get those people together without jumping worms and share their resources.
Dan in La Crosse has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Dan.
Sure.
Hi, we have a small hobby farm, and we did a 10-acre prairie patch, very diverse. It's been about 4 years, so it's starting to show more blooms. And we have some sheep and some cattle that we occasionally will run through it, to just do some grazing. Is there some species that you think that I should try to propagate that will you know, help keep the prairie healthy? And then a second question, I know you're talking about invasive species. University of Wisconsin, I believe, was working on a herbicide with Corteva that targeted wild parsnip. Has that become commercially available, or do you know anything about it?
Okay, on the cattle question, I would say if you've got it good established, if your prairie is getting well established, doing light grazing is not going to be a problem. I mean, and by light, I mean you don't want them, like we do have prairie restorations where, I mean, I've heard of prairie restoration. We don't have them here at the Arboretum because we don't run cattle, but where grazing is part of the management. And so that is something to look into. You might look at a blog called The Prairie Ecologist online. Just look that up. And he regularly, he's from Nebraska, he regularly talks about their grazing and burn management and just the types of, the way the species respond and how the prairie responds over time with the different management they're doing with grazing and with burning. So as far as the Corteva project dealing with the parsnip, I have not heard, I did hear a presentation or at a conference, some presentation by some folks from Corteva, but they weren't specifically talking about that dealing with the parsnip. I'll be all ears when that comes around because I know that the parsnip season is just underway, and I have some parsnip on conservation land that I deal with every year. But you really can, we are – we've definitely made a lot of progress with that. You just can't ignore a year with it, I don't think. And reducing disturbance and having a lot of native plants in the area can be very helpful with keeping that more under control. We're seeing a lot on roadsides. We're seeing a lot fields where there is a lot of disturbance. But in areas on restorations where you've done control of it, you're going to more see it on like stream side and edges and roadsides in those situations. So don't be discouraged about it, but don't let it get away from you.
Dan, there you go.
I'll be waiting for Corteva's news to see whether that makes sense in our setting.
Susan Carpenter, native plant garden curator and gardener at the UW Arboretum. Our guest, questions for her about natives. I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234. You can email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Taking a look at native plants today on the program with Susan Carpenter, native plant garden curator at the UW Arboretum. It's great to have her back to talk about what's going on there and to answer your native plant questions. Again, you can join in 800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org. Mary in Milwaukee emailed to ask where she can buy true native plants. She's found some at the Weir Nature Center, but most plant centers sell cultivars.
A good question. I'm encouraged really by the number of nurseries that are now getting established and starting, and some of these can be rather small. But many of the, you know, we have the larger nurseries like Prairie Nursery, of course, long-term business, and Prairie Moon Nursery, another long-term business. And those are nurseries that are not selling cultivars. They're selling true natives. And then other nurseries in the area are more moving into this space. So Johnson's is moving into the space with selling natives. And I think, and then all these new nurseries, like some just individuals who are starting nurseries and actually moving, because the demand is so good, moving very well into this. So I would advise to Mary, if she wants to get a list of these nurseries that are working with native plants and really a source for them, is to go to the Wisconsin DNR website and just put in the search bar native plants, and then a page will come up, and there is a link there to a directory of nurseries, including a lot of these newer nurseries that are available for native plants. And I think it's this movement is just going to continue and be very, very helpful because the demand is really great for them. And I appreciate Mary's attention to cultivars because sometimes a cultivar is modified enough that it really doesn't have the same biological characteristics that the wild type has.
Yeah, that's all very good advice. And I know Neil DeBole's operation. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you one thing. There is a lot of demand for it out there. I waited a bit too long. I needed to replace some native plants, and I waited a bit too long, and the ones I wanted were in very short supply. Let's put it that way. The natives.
Mm-hmm.
The true natives.
Yeah, and I think you can – another neat thing is that if you join a group like Wild Ones in your area, a chapter like that, if you have your own native plants growing, you're going to get more seeds than you know what to do with. And then other people's same thing is happening. So there's a lot of opportunities for sharing and exchanging, and that is such a great way to spread the message of native plant gardening as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You've been doing work with bumblebee conservation for a long time, especially that rusty patch bumblebee you mentioned earlier. How are things going?
Well, there is some news about that broad news about it. We've been seeing the rusty patch bumblebee here or monitoring it here at the Arboretum for about 15 years now. And through that time, of course, it's been rare through that time, but it wasn't listed as endangered until 2017. Just recently, the Fish and Wildlife Service designated critical habitat for rusty patch bumblebee. So this is in the areas of its remaining counties in its remaining range. So that includes our area. There's a lot of fine print in that designation. So I encourage people to go to the Fish and Wildlife Service. But it is an interesting step in thinking. I think what I take it as is a good example of how you can't just focus on an organism, but you do have to think about its habitat and the broader picture that, you know, the broader context that it lives in. And this is true for all organisms, but, you know, this endangered species has gotten a lot of attention, a lot of interest, and a lot of public, public support and public participation in monitoring and finding new locations and finding out nests and finding all kinds of information about this so that we can do a better job of conservation.
Barbara in La Crosse has a question. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, I'm so happy to get on and happy retirement. I am putting in for the last couple years clover to take over my lawn. I want it all clover. Mm-hmm. It's working quite well. I have found online lots of benefits to doing that, but I'm interested in what your guest would say.
About having white clover in your lawn?
Yeah.
It can be a very good, it's better than, as far as like pollinators are concerned, it can be a very helpful, can be a very helpful feature, much better than just lawn grass. And also I know that if you're growing clover, if I see your lawn and I can see that you're growing clover in it, I know that you're not using herbicide in your lawn. So that means that that's going to be a healthier environment for the pollinators as well, and probably for pets, children, etc. But you can mow it, and it'll still, you can mow it periodically. At times when you probably still have grass in there too, when the grass is growing not very fast, like later in the warmer part of the summer, then you can let it, and the clover is still growing and blooming, you can leave it for a little longer and not mow it, quite as short, and then there'll be a lot more flowers available for them. We had an occasion here one time where that was exactly the case, and we had red clover, white clover. There was some heal all, which is another plant in the lawn, and there were plantains and some other species of plants that were growing. And then I went out and documented there were 8 kinds of bumblebees and 6 kinds of butterflies and flies and honeybees and other insects using that lawn. And it wasn't a huge, huge, huge area. So it was kind of surprising that so much insect diversity was making use of it. So, I mean, I wouldn't, if you have a lawn and you just don't spray it, the white clover will usually show up. Sounds like Barbara's adding on to the white clover that might have showed up and probably has a pretty flowery thing. Another important thing to do is just if you have areas of your lawn that you could convert to larger flowering plants, especially native plants, then you'll have the kind of the best of both worlds there. You'll have multiple sources for your pollinators.
Barbara, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it very much. Susan, I understand you have a question for me.
I do, Larry. Thanks for asking. I was curious about, can you think of what's an important gardening trend that you've seen throughout your amazing career hosting Garden Talk?
Oh, I can think of a couple of things. And since we're talking about natives, I think one of the, 40 years ago, people thought you were weird if you were interested in native plantings in your home situation. I remember Neil DeBole saying that. He said people thought I was nuts when I 40 years ago when I started the nursery.
Uh-huh.
Started the nursery, and now natives are embraced, and I think that is maybe one of the biggest things that we've got going. And I think another is organic gardening methods. I think there's many more people are wanting to move away from synthetic pesticides. And I hear that every week on Garden Talk.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's a big thing. I mean, it used to be organic and then it was all chemicals, sort of. And now we've swung back. And that's all in my lifetime here.
And that's wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah. And well, And I think the hardiness zone changes.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that we're getting warmer longer,
yep,
is, gardeners are going to have to adjust to the longer growing season, maybe different plants. So
maybe different health issues avoid.
Yeah. All of that. So, I mean, I think the biggest one for me is the native plants and embracing native plants.
I'm very glad to hear that.
I've really appreciate that myself. And frankly, I appreciate, Susan, your work over there. It's been a lot of fun working with you.
It's been just great. And I know the Arboretum here, we all join your listeners and all the gardeners across Wisconsin, Larry, to thank you for all that you've done for everyone's learning.
Well, it's been my pleasure, I can tell you that. And I'm going to miss all the programs. I'll certainly miss Garden Talk. And maybe I'll call in once in a while with a question.
I was just hoping you would say that.
Thank you so much, Susan. Appreciate your time and your friendship. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Larry.
Susan Carpenter, the Native Plant Garden Curator and Gardener at the UW Arboretum. Boy, that was a lot of fun. And it's my last Garden Talk, my last official Garden Talk. And it's been really a great pleasure for me to be with you every Friday for all of these years just to talk about plants. It's been an honor and a pleasure. And it's been a pleasure working with our team, Clara Neipert, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, they're all part of the team. Of course, our executive producer and sort of overall boss, you might say, is Jill Nadeau, although we tend to work as a whole team here. And Jill leads it, but she leads it with a pretty light hand. Let's put it that way. Thank you so much for listening and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News. I'm Larry Mueller.